Do you know that every mind has an encompassing atmosphere similar in its essential nature to the mind itself, that thought, true or false, good or evil, would have extension, and exert an unconscious influence upon other minds, healthful or baneful, according to its own nature? Do you know that every heart is constantly carrying with it its own sphere, a sphere more penetrating and powerful, especially in its effect on the voting, and persons oftenest within its reach, than any oral or written instruction? There are spheres of selfishness, hatred, conceit, pride, jealousy, avarice, contempt and revenge, spheres of love, joy, peace, humility, reverence, confidence and trust, and that particular character or quality of spiritual sphere emanating from, and encompassing each individual, would be in all cases according to the character of the individual, not according to his or her words or outward actions, unless these were in agreement with his or her internal feelings and purposes. Anyone of much spiritual discernment, or who is at all susceptible to the influence of mental spheres, if he or she has ever been long in the immediate presence of very saintly or vile persons, knows from personal experience that what we have here spoken of, as altogether reasonable, is actually true. Go with us into the humble cabin or poorly furnished chamber of some good soul, how you will feel a sweet and heavenly peace as perceptibly as you ever smelled the perfume of clover blossoms or new-made hay, and experience is inexplicable upon any other theory than that of the existence of spiritual spheres. Do you know that a certain spiritual sphere encompasses you according to the life of your affection, which sphere is more perceptible to the spirits than a sphere of odor is to the most exquisite sense in the world? The spheres which are perceived in the spirit life, all arise from the loves and consequent affections in which the spirits had been principled, consequently from the life, for loves and consequent affections made the doctrine concerning spiritual spheres cordially accepted, and it is plain that its practical tendency and effect upon the receiver must be most salutary. This shows the present guardian and teacher and all who have the shaping of other minds, that it is not so much what they seem or say or do, as what they are not what they are outwardly but what they are inwardly, not so much their oral instructions, wise or otherwise, as the vital currents of thought and feeling perpetually flowing forth from their innermost and ruling love that mold the character of those under their charge. It is this spiritual atmosphere, extensive in itself and far-reaching enough to encompass a multitude of minds, that the souls are inhaling continually day by day, and hour by hour. How important it is then that this atmosphere be pure and sweet as the flower of heaven. We want to tell you, kind friends, that there is a spiritual world inhabited by spirits far more populous than the world in which you are now living, and as much more substantial, too, as the soul is more substantial than the body. All the inhabitants of the spirit world were once dwellers on your or some other earth, having commenced their existence on the lower plane of human life. It is easy to believe this, if you reflect upon what is happening every day in your world. Nor is there any space existing in the spirit world, yet things appear to be in space here, and spirits appear to go from place to place by the exercise of their powers of locomotion, the same as on earth. There are societies in the spirit spheres, some of them consisting of many hundreds of thousands of spirits, and as all in any society are not equally wise, you must expect to find some kind of government over here, and you should expect also that the wisest and best of the spirits would be appointed to take charge of the government, those who are least in the love or thought of themselves, and most in the thought and love of serving and who best know how to serve. We wish to state that everyone for the particular governmental position he or she is called to fill and is perceived and acknowledged by all, and that all administrative powers are so kindly and wisely exercised that no friction is felt in the work, but all move on as smoothly and harmoniously as a loving family or healthy human body. We say that there are governments and societies in the spirit spheres, and that there are various different conditions in the higher spheres from what they are in the lower spheres, and differing also according to the ministries performed by each society. But they all agree in this, that they regard the general good as their end, and in that good, every individual is a participant. This results from the fact that all in the spirit spheres are under the auspices of the all-wise teacher and leader who love all, and from divine love, ordains that the common good shall be the source of good to every individual. Some live in magnificent palaces and in more elevated situation than others. There are also temples for worship in the spirit spheres, for the spirits are being continually perfected in wisdom and love, and social conditions, here as well as on your earth there, are all means of growth. All who die in infancy and childhood go directly to the spirit spheres, that is, they pass immediately into a sphere of societies, and are instructed and governed by the higher spirits. Some become higher by intelligence. It does not depend on the character of their parents, as to whether they are religious or wicked. They have the same spiritual organism, and the same infantile forms and infantile minds that they had while in the world. They do not forever remain infants. They advance here to the full stature of men and women. They grow by the assimilation of spiritual substance, as children in your world grow by assimilation of material substance, for the bodies of both spirit and man are formed of the substances belonging to their respective worlds. Children in spirit spheres do not grow old as they do in your world. They never advance over here beyond a period of early manhood or womanhood, but retain forever the freshness and bloom belonging to that age. But they must attain to the highest perfection of the spirit form in order that they may reach spirit life in its fullest sense, and have their faculties unfolded, strengthened and perfected in the highest degree. This doctrine is not, as some suppose, a petty conceit or mere human invention, but has its foundation in the constitution of things, and is as true and exact as the science of mathematics. The life of the spirit in the spheres is as one of gladness resulting from bliss, and consists in performing deeds of goodness which are works of charity. Those who have led a life withdrawn from worldly affairs, are possessed with the idea of their own merits, and are thence continually desirous of being admitted into the spirit spheres, and think of that joy as a reward, being totally ignorant of what that joy is. And when you are admitted among the spirits, and to a perception of their joy which is without the thought of merit, and consists in active duties and services openly performed, and in the blessedness arising from the good which they thereby promote, they are astonished like persons who witness things altogether foreign to their expectation. These things reveal to you the law as of the soul's higher life, and to develop within you a pure and holy character, a pure and unselfish love, and the higher and purer the truth you accept, the higher and more blessed the state of life to which you may reach. Order of natural causes, Dr. Reed, friends, when mankind have turned their backs on the right and plunged themselves into thick darkness, when habits of sin have blighted the conscience, and taunted and defiled every faculty of the soul, when the laws of nature have been broken, and denounce a curse against those who have trampled them under their feet, and when the pall of death broods over the whole race, and with no return from the grave has almost blotted out all faith in the soul's immortality, when life is short and death is near at hand and conscience accuses, and the laws of fear and remorse separated the souls of men from their great teacher, it needs a clearer and stronger voice than that so far heard, to restore peace to the troubled heart, to subdue the inveterate force of sin and open the pathway of a new life to the blighted soul. Spiritualism is complete and effective and meets every want of a human soul. As the phenomena and philosophy of spiritualism are true, no one to whom it is fully made known can reject them unless from the strong bias of an evil heart of unbelief, and no one truly receives it until the proper time and by the power of affection. You must yield to an influence still more powerful than sensual appetite or pride of false reason to the mighty attraction of the laws governing spiritual intercourse and the constraining power of evil. We bring the key which will unlock by degrees a thousand mysteries, and solve a thousand enigmas in your world. Even those who bring the key with them must often be content to wait, and the solution of each particular doubt or difficulty may depend on the previous solution of those in earth life. The credibility of events and demonstration, and the value of testimony are determined by the fixed laws of nature. It seems that the more remarkable any occurrence is, the more unprepared you are to view it calmly. Disbelief of an event or a phenomenon by no means implies a denial of the honesty or veracity of the impression on the mind of its doubter. It means merely that the probability of some mistake, somewhere, is greater than that of the event happening in the way, or from the causes assigned. Then again, if any strange, unaccountable fact were observed at the present day, an unbiased, educated person would not doubt for a moment, if a physical student, that it was due to some natural cause. These results have arisen from the growing study of the phenomena of natural law. This philosophy is based on one grand truth, the universal order and constancy of natural causes. Your own experience reveals the constant action of the human will upon the human body, and upon all portions of matter that lie within the range of the muscular strength and physical powers of man. True, these are small indeed, compared with the forces ever at work in the great cosmical system, but still their action, through successive ages, has wrought sensible effects even on the physical condition of spiritual things on earth. Then let us conceive of spiritual beings who have power over matter and seeming immutability of physical law, even in the case of planetary movements. But you say you have no proof from reason alone that such creatures exist in the universe. But you have proof, however, on grounds of pure reason, and demonstration, that the constancy for thousands of years of the planetary courses, undisturbed by spiritual agencies immensely more potent than the human will, is a counterpart on a large scale to the quiet and silent growth of all life. If a message from a spirit in the higher or lower realm which affirms its own origin, and was accompanied by no credential worthy of its author, it would be open, without defense to the charge of being a mere dream of imagination, and might be transferred at once from the region of facts and real history to the imagination. There are facts fixed, unalterable, internal and incapable of being varied by the will of man, or a personal God. The truth will never be revealed to you so long as you shrink from the duty which seems to be in the highest plane, however difficult to fulfill, and to know what the basis is on which the whole of your spiritual consciousness stands. There must be facts which hold up all the spiritual edifices of thought and life. You will never be at peace so long as you doubt one another. Why are you afraid, as you seem to be, in dealing with the greatest truth? Is it because you are narrow in the limits of human understanding, and relegate it to the depths of mystery? Is not the prevailing tendency of the mind the confession of its own importance? And yet it does not at all follow, because you fail to grasp great truths with the hand of conceptive power, which is understanding, and which is trained to lay hold of spiritual things and such. Truths must be ignored and put back into an abyss of the unknown and unknowable. You may not be able to formulate any definition in spiritual things which are accepted by all spiritualists, but you may nevertheless be able to open to the clear view of the soul what these primary truths are which come forth to the people, and in the spirit world. So it is in your study of nature, scientific systems and schemes of inductive reasoning, on facts, and conclusions and anticipations drawn from facts, and the work of human thought and observation. But it remains the greatest fact of all, the universally known and acknowledged of all truths, such as the continuity of life and all forces and existences, and the steadfastness of a natural law. And yet the unbelieving man of science is content to use familiar abstract terms to describe these facts. There are more things in the spirit realms and on earth than are dreamed of in all your philosophies. Spirits have been speaking to men in every age and in every place. Gems of thought, Dr. Reed. Annihilation would be a blessing in comparison to the orthodox idea of immortality. All truths, both spiritual and natural, harmonize. One truth cannot be opposed to another truth. A deep, impenetrable gloom is always hanging between the evil-minded and the celestial world. All creation is a matter of growth, the moral creation of the soul being that of which you have no certainty. Yet there are those in other faiths who do face death without a fear or tremor, to whom it means but an incident in the whole story of life. Don't think that the shadow of death is so black because you have put about it your superstitious customs, you have allowed it to become in your thinking the triumph of an archenemy, you have accentuated the dark aspects with your accidental customs of mourning, and you seem to have lost faith in the persistence of life, You hold a creed of immortality with your lips and deny it with your acts. You think the sorrow of parting is bitter enough without your deliberate end of life to add to the gall in the cup. If you believe the words you say, why should you fear to die, and why should you weep as if those who have gone from you had passed forever from a world of sunshine into some dark and cheerless land? What sort of heaven can there be, my friends of earth, if you thus mourn when your loved ones pass over there? What right have you to talk of death as if it were the inevitable proof of the undoing of some infinite power of darkness? If you believe that the Lord of all life rules the universe here, and that love is stronger than even the grave, might you not turn to see in this but an end of one chapter, a beginning of the page for the next, a step in the journey into new and better scenes? You usually hold a creed involving belief in immortality, but because you have made that future so strangely conditioned, so dubious, because you have allowed yourselves to be whipped like dull slaves by the mortal terrors of the grave into superstitious subjection, you have lost the real value of immortality. You live in dread of dying. How can you lose the fear of death? Not by any drafts on imagination as to the felicities that await a few beyond the grave, but by coming in contact with the spiritual forces and by emphases on the value of life itself, by so filling the present with this power and value that it becomes victorious over any fear for the future. The better you make the life that now is, the more you may be assured of its duration through all vicissitudes. There are values and realities in earth life that death cannot touch. What poor bundles of clay you are if you may be destroyed, utterly blotted out by slight chemical changes. What narrow view of life is yours if the grave may touch its really vital being. Every true man knows he is immortal. You can laugh and bid defiance to all that destroys the flesh, for you are more than clay. Spiritualism overcomes the fear of death. You see life as that which goes on from stage to stage and moves in into better beings and steps ever forward into the light of eternal peace. This is the message of spiritual light and truth. It points beyond the crumbling clay to the laws which show all life everlasting and fends its endorsement in the undying hope cherished through all generations in the breasts of men, that beyond the door of death you enter into the larger room. Then fear turns to hope and the dread of death to the glad expectation of a freer and better life. It is said that no man can tell by what power he or she is controlled. You often act from impulse, impression, without thought or reason. Moments of inspiration are not under the control of the mind or the will. They travel in no well-defined orbit. Their appearance cannot be foretold. The most beautiful thoughts and its expression are fleeting. They have to be caught on the instant or they are forever gone. Art sometimes is an improvement on nature, but it more often deforms. Men and women display physically and outwardly what they are, mentally and spiritually. When the heart speaks one language and the lips in other words, they lose their meaning. Every person is controlled, none are free. You are all subject to natural laws as well as human laws. A hospital nurse's experience. Pauline Frederica Strong: for 15 years I was a hospital nurse and attended more largely on the poor ward patients. It would be difficult for you to imagine one half the misery and pain that was pressed into my existence all through that most exceedingly unhappy time. Yet I was never happy unless I was doing something for some sufferer, and so you see I could no more change my life or my vocation than I could create myself over again. It naturally had fallen to my lot all the years almost of my life, to hear the woeful tales of sorrow from almost every mortal I came in contact with, and was almost driven to nursing from sheer sympathy. I soon found that my strong feelings of tenderness for those afflicted made me overweak and unfit for duty. And so the years brought for discipline, courage and success, and lost me love, truth and purity. For as I witnessed such a multitude of suffering, I began to grow more and more callous to its call, until I went at the call of duty only as a machine goes which is set in motion mechanically and at the will of its operator. Something was dying in me, not my good physical health, for I was most unusually robust. But something which used to speak to my inner consciousness, from my own inner self, that still small voice which men and women call the conscience for want of a better term. That thing was dying, even had died. When I found my faith in humankind departing, I was appalled. I grew a while in terror of myself, until at last I settled down into the natural course of things, got down into a healthy material groove, reasoned from a materialistic standpoint, lived an infant and was of the earth earthy. My associates did the same if they were successful, and if not they retired back into the places from where they came. Poor, dear girls. The men I knew were a hard lot of unprincipled physicians who wielded power in finances and politics, and we nurses were trained in their school. I grew to be a good servant of mammon, worshipping at the shrine of a god of frivolous pleasures, working and toiling only for material recompense in dollars and cents and not because there might be a higher and holier aspiration in my daily labor than this. At last I came only to judge my friends' value for what prowess and power they held in the circles of the world's people. Just for actually what money they possessed. And I grew to live so continually on this plane of life that my sympathies were rarely if ever awakened for the better influences in life. One cheerless dreary damp day in December there came a tiny half-shrunken little waif of a girl child into one of the beds of my south ward. The eyes were closed as they laid her on the bed, as if in death, and the tiny over-old, pinched features of her face told of a certain suffering that seemed to pierce into my breast and cut like a knife. And from the first moment I saw her, I felt a strange intangible desire gripping me to stay close by her side and never leave her. And how coldly I laughed and scorned my own thoughts and feelings and drove these vague impulses from me like some troubled dream. But I have just as soon tried to stay myself from her bedside as a piece of steel from a magnet, for she drew me, and I at last scarcely left her, only to go at a sterner command of duty calling, ever calling. At last this little starveling spoke and ate nourishing food, and was propped up on the pillows and told me that she was begging for food, when the great wheeled van struck her, and broke both her legs and she was brought to St. Mary's. She told me that she had had nothing to eat for almost 3 days when she was hurt. At her words, a great swelling something rose up in me, and I feared for myself, for I was angry at the cruelty of starvation. And I then wanted to go out and feed all the hungry, but with a mighty effort I again laughed at my insane weakness and settled down into a hospital nurse again, stayed myself down into that same wordless, stony-hearted, miserable creature that the people of the world call kind and noble, but alas, they do not know. Once I asked this little creature her name and age and she said, "Age is nothing to me, I don't know what age is, and my name is Happy, just plain Happy. Least that's what they call me everywhere." At last I knew that she had come out of the filth of the dirty streets where naught lives but treachery and wickedness and wrong. I was indeed a foolish woman to listen for a moment to any such a story. Once when I had gone out and left her sleeping, I heard a feeble cry and returning quickly I saw her with outstretched arms and half-raised body muttering something, with her gaunt roaming eyes fixed, in rapt awe on the ceiling. Not understanding, I asked her what she was doing. "Begging," she answered, "when I's hungry I does that to him, and then I goes out and begs of them as I see in the streets, but now I ain't hungry, but I's begging to be took away so's I won't be hungry no more." And this was prayer, ah, so long, my heart had forgotten. I cannot tell you with what a new and rapt inspiration I began life after this little foundling had taught me once more just how to pray. When she was dying I stood close over her with all the old sophistries and cynicism gone forever, for now that I had entered a new existence I was rising constantly above the mean conventionalities of the mundane sphere and living in close communication with other forces that I, as yet, realized little of. When, as I tell you, the experience of this little waif dying in my care as she raised those great sad, roaming eyes upward, searching the walls and ceiling for some familiar thing. I watched her intently and asked her what it was she wished. She told me that she saw there the dazzling whiteness of many forms and faces of smiling peace and happiness and that they were calling her incessantly to come to them. Gazing, I wondered and looking into the perfect quietude of the concentration of death, I heard strange sweet whispers float over my waiting and astonished ear. They spoke of peace and eternal blessing, and like a flash of inner hearing I knew that I would live after death, for these were only disembodied spirits that spoke to me, and that were showing themselves so radiantly happy to little happy of the streets. A great joy swelled within my soul, and as my little world sick soul on the bed, left the body and soared away, I looked long and intently, and to my absolute astonishment I saw her. Her real self arisen and moving upward in the arms of some mighty one and carried out of my astounded sight. It is needless to say that I sent up a strong prayer of supplication, of pleading that I might be forgiven and deserve the happiness that possessed me. Daily I grew, but with another growth, a soul awakening, whereas I had been passing through a spiritual death. But little happy, that strange, pathetic little bundle of rags, had given me a new birth, and I began to feel the breathing of the soul growing into new thoughts, pure and wholesome, and which drove away all the old materialistic and sordid desires. I soon began to see people's souls as well as their outer covering, and I was astonished at my power of second sight, as I called it. And now all the ties and obligations of the old life seemed mean and ignoble, and when I saw once and for all that the greater portion of the so-called physicians were not attending on an high and holy mission of actual relief to the sick, but that their daily lives and acts of medical practice were actuated almost alone on the principles of charlatanism, lying and trickery, I was really appalled. You see, I had begun to see with the eyes of the soul, to feel within the inner depths, and now I could no longer blindly go headlong into the future and aid in carrying out the plans of these most wily, unprincipled men, for indeed they were most falsely preying upon an innocent public, and have always, and are doing so today. God pity them when they enter the boundaries of this beautiful world, for those of whom they have shed innocent blood, through needless and misapplied surgery, will rise up before them in mighty armies and mock them unceasingly. Those of whom it has been said in your world, "Oh yes, the operation was very successful, but well, the patient was too weak to rally." So it would seem that the life of the patient was held in but small esteem, but the operation was the most important thing to be considered, and if that was successfully accomplished, then the patient might die or live, a matter of little consequence in either case. So when I received my new sight, I went to the superintendent and told him my intention of giving up my position of nursing the sick and suffering at large, on my own account, and in the run of our conversation I told him why. Told him that I could no longer aid the nefarious work of the cruel men of that institution, and he informed me that I might go in 2 weeks hence. Alas! Could I have seen? I went to my room shortly after and retired for the night, but was awakened from my first sleep by two masculine voices, holding low converse close to the foot of my bed. Then I heard footsteps, and an unspeakable horror seized me. Before I could struggle or call out, strong arms lifted me and pinioned me tight, while deft fingers threw a white cloth saturated with some sickening, deadly drug over my face, and I could not choose but breathe the deathly poison into my lungs. And this was the last I remembered of mortal life. And I awoke at last as if from a deep sleep, and stood alive and with a new sense of life, gazing on the pale coldness of my corpse on the bed, in the light of the grey winter morning. And lo, as I stood there, these two, my murderess, came creeping in, and taking a bottle of poison, stealthily placed it into the stiffening and nerveless fingers of my lifeless body. I recognized then immediately, one as the assistant hospital physician and the other as the head of the institution. "The dead do not tell tales," they whispered as they stole out, "only that little vial in her hand will be accountable for the loss of Mrs. Strong." With the awful sorrow of one looking on a doomed soul did my spirit eyes follow those men as they left my room and went their way, nor did the walls between us hide them, for spirits can read the acts of men through the darkness and solidity of walls or other material obstructions. They turned my body and I witnessed the dreary service to the end. And then appeared in the papers the account of another unhappy woman, a hospital nurse, who committed suicide by swallowing poison. For a long, long period of time, possibly years of earthly reckoning, I was bound to earth by the terrible cause of my passing. But gradually I tore myself away from those low vibrations and rose into realms ethereal with those of the happier and the eternally blessed. And now I come and give my blessing unto this circle forever. Confidence and faith in humanity. Dr. Reed, of all the influences that contribute to the progress of mankind, Faith and confidence in humanity are the greatest. But the fine economy of the spirit nature that you need to believe in, is necessary to know man, in order to bring out all the elements in his soul. The crimes of all great criminals or impostors are in consequence of the violence done to man's faith in man. They reach beyond the confines of the human problem of faith, and like the problem of love, they are open to question. If man does not believe in his brother whom he has seen, how can he believe in a God whom he never seen? It is certain, however, that the great souls